I think given the commitments from the Scottish Government now to undertake climate impact assessments on these kinds of projects, I think it's going to be very, very clear that it actually isn't viable to dual the whole way.
That was Maggie Chapman, Scottish Green MSP in the North East, and we'll be hearing more from her later in the show. Hello and welcome to The Stooshy, the Scottish politics podcast from DC Thompson Media that helps you be better briefed. I'm Andy Phillip, political editor at the Press and Journal, and on this episode I'll be joined by my colleagues Rachel Amory and Callum Ross to examine and explain the last week in Scottish politics. But first, a summary of the week's biggest national and international politics stories, compiled and read by Morag Lindsay.
The Scottish Government has declared it will set up its own so-called green ports with special tax status after accusing UK ministers of failing to provide guarantees about fair pay and set up funding. Scotland's Trade Minister, Ivan McKee, announced his independent plans months after work got underway in England. It means the UK Government will now also push ahead with one of their own in Scotland, potentially in Aberdeen, Dundee or Cromarty Firth. The number of European Union nationals who are living in the UK has fallen, according to official figures. The Office for National Statistics data for 2020 showed that within a year, the population of EU nationals in the UK dropped by 200,000, from 3.7 million to 3.5 million. Experts have said the COVID-19 pandemic and Brexit have likely been factors in people's decision to move from or to the country. The University of St Andrews has become the first to beat Oxford and Cambridge to be named the top university in the UK in an annual guide. It's the first time a different institution has been at the top of the Times and the Sunday Times Good University Guide, which has been running since 1993. Meanwhile, the University of Glasgow was named Scottish University of the Year and is placed 12th in the UK-wide league table.
Thank you, Morag. Now let's start with a big issue facing the whole country, the incredible pressure on Scotland's emergency services. We're talking the day after First Minister Nicola Sturgeon called in the army to help take the strain. There's been simmering anger about lack of investment, about the facing the political... There's been simmering anger about investment at a political and service level for a long time. Rachel, you've been watching events unfold. How did we get into this mess?
Yeah, it's been going on for quite a while now, hasn't it? And it's not just a problem for Scotland. There are similar issues happening elsewhere in the UK as well. And it's one of these things, when we all hope that when we need an ambulance, that within minutes you'll start to hear the sirens outside racing towards you. But unfortunately, the reality in the past few weeks has been far from that for some people. A Conservative leader, Douglas Ross, he actually raised an issue in Holyrood about a 65-year-old man called Gerard Brown. Now, he had to wait 40 hours for an ambulance and he actually ended up, unfortunately, dying. And we've had plenty other examples of things such as this that we've covered extensively across the DCT media titles. I mean, we've, an 88-year-old man with dementia in Montrose, he had to wait 15 hours. A 62-year-old man from Argyll, he had a heart attack and his wife called and was told there was no ambulance available. A woman in her 80s in Aberdeen waited 13 hours and her son claims that the ambulance only arrived after he pleaded for help on Twitter. I mean, we could go on. There are countless cases like this at the moment. Dr. Sandesh Gulhani, he's the Conservatives' shadow health minister and he's also a GP himself too. And he says this is horrific because we think of Scotland as being an advanced country, and yet this is how some of the most vulnerable in society are being left in at the moment. One of the reasons is emergency workers at the moment are dealing with around 10,000 more calls a month than the same time last year, which is just an insane number when you sit and think about it, isn't it? And there are a lot of reasons why more people are calling for an ambulance now. There are rising coronavirus cases, that's part of the problem. But if you remember, a lot of surgeries and non-COVID care has been delayed over the past 18 months. And so the people who have missed out on these things in the past months during the pandemic, they're now sicker than they were before and more in need. So people are also waiting longer than usual as well to get help for their problem. Again, that's probably an effect of the pandemic and a worry of putting too much pressure on the NHS. So people's problems are more complex and severe and need ambulance care. Maybe it wouldn't have done before.
Well, the pandemic, though, it's the cause of much of the current problems, isn't it? But it also being used as a bit of an excuse for past failures. That's what some of the opposition MSPs might be saying. I mean, Is that the reason? Is there a bit of a smokescreen as well?
Smokescreen is actually the exact word that Santosh Gilhani used on the radio to describe this. He says that 2 years ago, before the pandemic started, he called for an ambulance and it was an 8-hour wait. So there is obviously problems that are not pandemic related when it comes to this as well, isn't there?
Like bed blocking and other things that happened at the start of the pandemic, where you have delayed discharges, to give them more their sort of formal name. The pandemic exposed a lot of perhaps underfunding in areas across the country, and has really kind of put a lot back on the table for the First Minister about how the budget is going to be in the future, and how we're supposed to be setting up a national care service, we're supposed to be doing lots and lots and lots of things, but we've ended up having to call the army in.
I know, it's quite a drastic move to go to that, isn't it? But the move has actually been welcomed by opposition parties. They say that it's been good to get that help from them, but they did caveat that by saying that the government should have done more sooner so that situation didn't happen. So hopefully now, with the army coming in, it will get a little bit better, because if you're ever in that situation and you desperately need an ambulance, you don't want to be waiting more than a day and a half for one to come, do you?
Well, Nicola Sturgeon was on the spot with our health secretary yesterday, Humza Yousaf. She might be content with her cabinet at the moment, but there's she had to reshape it just recently with the Greens. But there's been a lot of action south of the border too. Boris Johnson's been reshuffling his top team of ministers. Callum, you've been having a look at that. There's a few casualties, a few egos getting pricked. Maybe any impact we're likely to actually notice?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, Andy. I mean, it's a reshuffle day is always a kind of, and the way it's handled is always a kind of odd and brutal tradition at Westminster, isn't it? You don't see it playing out like that in other countries to the same extent. It's obviously a lot of drama, provides a lot of drama for journalists and political anoraks, but can't be much fun for some of the people involved. Yeah, I mean, in terms of Scotland, Alistair Jack obviously remains as Scottish Secretary. I don't think that's a huge surprise. Things are relatively quiet in terms of the battle over a second independence referendum at the moment, so there's probably no point for the Prime Minister making any waves there. The other one is Michael Gove. There's an interesting dynamic between Michael Gove and Boris Johnston, obviously two of the most high-profile Tories in terms of the Leave campaign and the Brexit referendum that had a bit of a falling out over the 2016 Tory leadership election. Michael Gove had previously been in this obscure role of Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, which ended up being a bit of a kind of roving role in government, I think, in Cabinet Office, and he sort of emerged as almost the Minister for the Union, kind of playing a really important role in terms of the UK government's relationship with Scotland and the other devolved administrations, probably the most important person in the UK government in terms of that. And that looks like it's going to continue in terms of his new job in communities, which will also kind of take charge of the whole levelling up agenda, which is quite important to the Conservatives.
Well, we're looking at some of the things that they're doing in Boris Johnson's government. We were talking earlier about the real pressure that's on the health service here and the ambulance service and things like that. But it's by no means unique to Scotland. This has been across the UK, and I think England were quicker to need to call in military assistance in some sense. But no change there, I don't think, in the health department. There's a few other kind of eye-catching things that maybe say a little bit more about the way that the governments are being led, the direction they take. Germany's culture minister is an art historian. France's has written a book on Verdi. The UK's ate ostrich anus on ITV's I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. That might be funny here, but is that kind of elitism, snobbishness, maybe just a clear sign that we're kind of in a bit of a dreary kind of culture war as well, the different directions, this sort of sense of where the government's going? Or is it a sign that we're run by a bit of an embarrassment or just shuffling the deck chairs around? I mean, what can we actually take from it? Does it mean anything really, or are we just new faces and doing the same thing?
And you're referring to Nadine Dorris, I assume she's our new culture secretary, obviously an author as well. I mean, that kind of promotion was a bit of a surprise for many people, I think, and has been seen as a bit of an attempt to score points, I suppose, with the Tory faithful by taking it to all the left-wing snowflakes in the arts community. She doesn't seem to be afraid to fan the flames there. You know, when it comes to dishing out jobs and cabinet reshuffles, prime ministers, I think, have always rewarded people around them who've been loyal, close allies, whether that's right or wrong way to go about things. The Johnson government, you know, that sense has kind of been amplified, I think, by the fact that most of the cabinet had come from the Brexit supporting wing of the party. That some might say, you know, that's left a fairly small pool of talent to pick from. Since Boris Johnson became Prime Minister, it's meant that there's some people in pretty high-profile roles that maybe few would have tipped for higher office a few years ago. Boris Johnson this week has got rid of Gavin Williamson, who seemed to have become a bit of a joke figure, and he's also demoted the Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, who of course decided to stay on holiday as Afghanistan was falling to the Taliban. You know, I don't think either of these will be seen as huge losses by many people, but there's still the likes of Priti Patel remaining in post, and then obviously, as you mentioned, the rise of Nadine Dorris. I mean, one thing for sure, it's gonna be interesting to watch how she gets on in that role.
Coming back a bit closer to home again, the Scottish government's kind of reshuffle. Could you call it a reshuffle? I mean, it was a complete reforming of the government, where we had two Green MSPs join the Scottish government with ministerial posts. We've been getting a fair bit of a hint in recent weeks about what this means for all aspects of public policy. Also infrastructure projects. So the A9 runs up the length of the country. It's going to carry on with its dualling, for example. But the A96 Aberdeen-Inverness Road might not be completed, all depending on whether an environmental review is seen as a kind of green light or a red light, I suppose. Earlier in the week, Adele Merson sat down with Maggie Chapman for a wide-ranging interview. They covered the dualling of the A96 and anti-Semitism, but she started by asking her, with seeing the Greens go into government for the first time, did it feel like a momentous moment?
It absolutely is, or was, a historic moment. It's been a whirlwind of a few months since we were all elected in May. And yes, having the first two Green ministers in the Scottish Government is quite a feat, I think. And I'm really looking forward to seeing how the next 4.5 years pan out and how we can use that influence to create a better world for everybody who lives and works in Scotland.
And in what particular areas do you think that your influence in government will be seen?
Well, I think that the portfolios that Patrick and Lorna have cover a lot of what we were able to agree in the cooperation agreement with the Scottish Government. And for me, the things that I'm really looking forward to seeing come to fruition are things like the New Deal for tenants. So having rent controls will be really, really significant for so many tenants across the country. You know, giving them the stability that they need in their housing, allowing them to plan financially and not to be at the mercy of private landlords who are using housing to make profit, when what we think housing should be there for as a human right. I think also, and probably most importantly, we need urgent action on the climate emergency, and there are a whole range of policies from building insulation all the way through to the just transition, you know, making sure that we create an economy that doesn't cost the earth, make sure that Scotland's future economy actually serves everybody in Scotland, not just the wealthy few, and also doesn't rely on extractive practices that are actually destroying the planet we live on.
You will, of course, be aware the future of the oil and gas industry has emerged as something of a real talking point ever since talks really started between yourselves and the SNP.
Yes.
I was speaking to Sir Ian Wood today, and he was saying that the industry cannot simply be turned off, that there's not with the expectation that the renewables industry can just sort of pick up the slack there, because he says the jobs, like low carbon jobs and technologies, are not available at scale. Do you think your party's stance, which is really to wind down the industry at speed, does not threaten thousands of jobs in the Northeast region?
I think we have an opportunity, and probably the last opportunity, to keep the planet temperatures within the 1.5 degrees that the IPCC and other experts tell us is what is vitally important if we are to prevent runaway climate change. This is our chance. And why we need to be talking about this and doing this now is because we cannot afford to let what happened to the coal miners in the 80s and 90s happen to the oil and gas workers now. We need a coherent plan that sees investment in job creation, investment in skills development, investment in training, investment in the things that go around all of those things to make communities in the Northeast and elsewhere in Scotland viable into the future. But we need to be starting implementation of that plan now. We cannot wait until 2030 and say, oh dear, it's too late, and then see hundreds of thousands of job losses. We know we've already lost tens of thousands of jobs in oil and gas in Scotland over the last few years. So we need to be making sure that we are planning and implementing that plan to make sure that we actually do secure the hundreds of thousands of jobs in the future that we're going to need. Pretending like we are not going to come to the end of oil and gas as our main energy economy is, I think, not only is it dishonest, but it's also deeply dangerous. We need to make sure that we have the plan in place and we have the procedures to get us to that point right now. And that is why it is so important for us to be talking about a just transition. It is so important for us to be talking about this, especially in the year that Scotland hosts the COP26 climate conference later on in the year. You know, we have an opportunity here. We have an opportunity to determine a livable future, not only for the Northeast, not only for Scotland, but for the world more broadly. And if we don't grasp that with both hands by 2030, it will be too late.
And speaking of that energy transition, I know that you are supporting the campaign to save the award-winning wetlands in Aberdeen, which is known as Sitfitics Park.
Yes.
From industrial development, they have plans there for an energy transition zone. What action do you hope the government will take on this? And is it not a decision really for the local council?
So what we want to see, what the community campaigners have been arguing for and fighting for over the last few months, has been a very, very clear commitment from Aberdeen City Council and from the Scottish Government that we need to protect St Fitticks Community Park. St Fitticks Community Park sits alongside Dooney's Rare Breeds Farm as well, and taken together, these areas, it's greenbelt land and it's urban green space. This is vital green space for the Torrey community. Torrey is one of the most deprived areas of Scotland. It's one of the most deprived communities in the country. And this green space is really the only accessible green space that community has. We know that, as you mentioned, St Fitticks Community Park has within it an award-winning wetland. It also has woodland, it has grassland, it has recreational facilities for children, it has archaeological interest. And all of these things have not only cultural and amenity value for the residents and community in Torrey and further afield, but also has vital significance in terms of what kind of future we want to see. So when I've been talking to the campaigners and when we've been trying to make sure we protect this area, it's not because we don't want to see a just transition. Far from it. We know we need energy transition zones. We know we need to see sites designated and developed to secure, you know, wind turbine manufacture, to secure decommissioning, to create the kinds of jobs in renewables and other things that we have to see as part of our energy and economic future in Scotland. But we need to do it in a way that is just. You know, that's what we talk about when we talk about a just transition. For me, a just transition brings together economic justice, environmental justice, and social justice. And if we ride roughshod over the wishes and desires of one of the most deprived communities of Scotland, that does not serve justice, in my view. So what I'm asking the Scottish Government to do is make support for the energy transition zone. We know they are committed to supporting it, which is great, but make that support conditional on the siting of that zone being sympathetic to community values and community wishes. There are brownfield sites close by. There are brownfield sites in Altons and in the East Tullis industrial site that could serve exactly the same purpose. And so it's about looking at things in the round, looking at things as a whole and saying, you know, this is a vital green space for communities, for Torrey itself. It is of high nature value. And at a time when we not only face a climate emergency, but a nature emergency too, we should be protecting sites that have high nature value. And we know there are alternatives. So we want the Scottish Government to stand firm on this and to say that actually just transition is important. We support the principles of the just transition. That means listening to local people, making sure local people's wishes are taken on board, and making sure we don't destroy vital green space that the community love and use.
Now, the SNP and the Greens, they've agreed in their deal to hold distinct positions on plans to dual the A96. I know a review is now going to be carried out on the project. Mm-hmm. Of course, many communities in the northeast are relying on these vital upgrades. Do you believe the project should now be abandoned?
I think we have to look at all big infrastructure projects and consider very carefully what it is we're actually trying to achieve with them. You know, if we were sitting here in the 1970s when we were at the beginning of the private car age, I think it would be very, very obvious where public money would need to be invested. But we aren't. We are sitting here at a point of climate crisis. We are sitting here at a point where we know our ecosystems and our habitats are more vulnerable than they have ever been before. And we also know that we have the opportunity to connect communities very, very differently. You know, we've seen in that same cooperation agreement, you know, substantial commitments to rail infrastructure, to other connectivity infrastructure that won't have the embedded carbon emissions in it, won't design future carbon emissions into their creation. And I think, you know, from our point of view, we need a very, very clear understanding of what these kinds of infrastructure developments are for, why they need to go ahead in the way they do, and can we actually get those same outcomes in ways that don't cost the earth. As far as the A96 is concerned, there are very clear areas where there does need to be some work done for safety purposes and other things like that. But I think we need to take a step back and again look at this in the whole. What are we trying to achieve here? If it's just about building roads, then no, I have no interest in that. If it is about connecting communities and allowing people to travel safely and in low emission or zero emission ways, then that's what we should be focusing on. So I would much rather see our investment go into ensuring that we have decent, reliable, fast, and frequent rail services that run on renewable energy. I want us to make sure that we have other connectivity infrastructure that means that people don't actually need to travel as much. I think we need to make sure we connect our rural communities much, much more effectively with public transport, both trains and buses. And so I think, you know, this, when we say let's look at this one road project, it's not just about one road project. It's about a much bigger piece, to do with climate emissions, to do with community connectivity, to do with a whole range of other infrastructure that we need to be looking at.
So would the Greens still be open-minded that it might still be required, or is it more that the party is actually opposed to the full dueling of the A96?
I think we made our position in our manifesto clear, and I think given the commitments from the Scottish Government now to undertake climate impact assessments on these kinds of projects, I think it's going to be very, very clear that it actually isn't viable to duel the whole way. That doesn't mean to say we can't tackle specific issues of safety or of congestion, but I think there are ways other than just building roads everywhere that allow us to increase connectivity, increase viable public transport options for people. So, because we know actually rail travel is not only better for the environment, it's also safer, and those are the things that we need to be seeing investment in.
And just finally, there have been calls recently for Nicola Sturgeon to clarify where her government stands on anti-Semitism. It's come off the back of a motion which I believe the Greens passed in 2015 that said Hamas was not a terrorist organisation and branded Israel an apartheid state. I'm just curious, where do you and indeed your party stand on this now?
Thanks. That's an important question. And I think a couple of things in response to that. Firstly, anti-Semitism in all of its forms is wrong. It's about prejudice and discrimination, and it has no place in an outward-looking and welcoming Scotland. However, I think it's important also to recognise that there are certain actions that states take that are unacceptable, that are in breach of international law, and that do not serve the peaceful future that we are trying to be, that we want to be part of, that we want to help create. So I think it's an important thing to consider. What is it when we say that the Israeli state is an apartheid state? We are not talking about individuals. We are not talking about people of faith. We are not talking about people who are or are not affiliated to any religious belief. What we are talking about are the actions that the Israeli state has taken against Palestinian people in its illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories. And it's those behaviours that we seek to tackle. Because they are in breach of international law, they are causing untold suffering for Palestinian people. And we believe that in the same way as you or I have the right to exist, so do Palestinian people have the right to exist and live free from the tyranny of occupation.
And do you think this puts you at odds with, say, the SNP stance on this?
I think we are having discussions with the Scottish Government on this. I don't believe that our view on anti-Semitism is different. I think Nicola Sturgeon and the Scottish Government are very, very clear, as we are, that anti-Semitism is unacceptable and anti-Semitism is wrong. I think we may, and across our parties, between the two parties, I'm pretty sure there are a variety of views of the role of the Israeli state in all of this. But we have those ongoing discussions. But fundamentally, do I believe that the Scottish Government has a different view on anti-Semitism to us? No, I don't. I think both the Scottish Greens and the Scottish Government believe that anti-Semitism is wrong and has no place in Scotland.
Okay, thank you, Maggie.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adele, talking there with Maggie Chapman, the North East Green Party MSP. And there was lots to go on there. We got a sense of kind of where the Scottish Greens and the SNP are starting to differ and where public opinion and, dare I say, votes will ultimately be counted. So, Callum, it sometimes feels like our ancestors have been writing about the A96 since the time fossil fuels were being formed in the ground. How important is something as mundane sounding as a road to a region like the Northeast?
Hugely important, Andy, as we both know, and we've both been written about the A96 and obviously also the Aberdeen Western Peripheral Route. campaigns for both of those roads for many years. Not just the North East, of course. A96 links Aberdeen and Inverness. I think I'm correct in saying that the Scottish Government's policy used to be that all Scotland's cities should be connected by dual carriageway, and that dueling the A9 and A96 would complete that. So it is quite interesting if Aberdeen and Inverness are the only Scottish cities that shouldn't be connected by dual carriageway. Now, I think, you know, a lot of people probably think about Aberdeen when they think about the A96, but you've got to remember all these towns and villages in Aberdeenshire that use it to commute into Aberdeen and go shopping, even into Moray. You know, the A96 is hugely important, and also, you know, there's huge traffic between Inverness and Aberdeen itself, and, you know, most of that traffic has to go through all these towns and places in Moray and several in Aberdeenshire as well. So yeah, it's a massive thing. I mean, my sense with this whole A96 dueling issue that's come out of the cooperation agreement is that it's a bit of a fudge. The Greens are getting to give the impression that they've scored a bit of a victory in terms of this big infrastructure project might not be going ahead. They obviously, you know, they're against spending billions of pounds on new roads. That's their long-standing position. So it looks like they've won a bit of a victory there. But, you know, for the SNP, they can say it's just a review, nothing's really changed, while also allowing the narrative to develop that it's the Greens that are to blame for this dueling project being scaled back. But the truth is that there are major doubts about the government's commitment to dueling the A96 long before this cooperation agreement. You've got to remember, this is a plan to duel the entire route between Inverness and Aberdeen that was supposed to be completed by 2030. So that's 8 years away and they've not started. It's still on the drawing board. The government's latest infrastructure investment plan has just £20 million down to spend on this £3 billion project in the next 5 years. So, you know, they weren't going to make any progress on this in the next 5 years anyway. So there are big issues there. The Nairn bypass section, which is supposed to be one of the first to be built, that was supposed to be completed by this year, but they've only just kind of agreed to the route, I think. It's only just been given the green light. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. My suspicion would be that the SNP thought the political consequences of easing off on the A9 dueling would be too much to stomach, but the A96 work hasn't begun yet, so could probably be kicked into the long grass a bit. But you mentioned political consequences, and we heard from Adele's interview as well. You know, it comes at a time where obviously there is a lot of discussion about North Sea oil and gas, and a potential change in the SNP's support for North Sea oil and gas. I mean, if the A96 dueling, £3 billion A96 dueling is being abandoned, if that happens, and they also kind of are seen to be turning their backs on North Sea oil and gas jobs in the northeast of Scotland, you know, that does leave them open to attack, I think, the SNP in one of their traditional sort of heartlands. The Tories have made up ground at some recent elections in the northeast, and although they've lost some seats as well recently, but you know, they'll be looking to take advantage of that, and it's going to be interesting to watch.
Broadly as well, I mean, you could say it's not that hard to argue that the Greens and the wider environmental movement have already kind of won the argument long term. Everyone knows we need to change our attitudes. And, you know, people who work in the oil industry know that as well, that, okay, things have to change. But where the frustration maybe is across the country, I mean, in general, where there's the big kind of yawning gap is where everyone wants to see the big detailed alternative plan. But even listening to Maggie Chapman there a little bit as well, she's talking about how we need a plan, we need this, we need that. And I think, I suppose that's the problem that the SNP face in general, and the Greens ultimately too, because if it's all about what we must stop doing, but people don't see a real alternative to what waits for them, then that's where it just hits a brick wall again. I mean, Rachel, you listened to Alok Sharma this week. He is, well, you can explain why he was there better than me, but he's attached to the UK's the UN Climate Summit, which is coming to Glasgow. He was in Holyrood talking sort of big picture about the issues that are facing us. I mean, did you hear anything approaching a plan or an escape route when you were listening to what's happening in the wider kind of environmental problem that we're all trying to grapple with?
I suppose if you're asking for a detailed plan of what it is we actually need to do, probably not, no. So this is Alok Sharma. He's the president of COP26, which, as we know, is coming to Glasgow in November. And he was at Holyrood's Net Zero Energy and Transport Committee to go over plans of what's going to happen at COP26, what the main aims of it are going to be, and basically how do we know if this summit's been a success or not. And one of the things he was getting asked about was this just transition, particularly when it comes to the Northeast. I believe it was Liam Kerr, one of the Conservatives of the Northeast, that was bringing this up at the committee. And he was saying that just transition, it's not a problem that's unique to Scotland. It's a problem that every single country is facing right now. And he does say that these people who have jobs in this industry need to be well supported. They need to be given the right training, the right skill set, that they need to move to renewables. And that we need to do something to make sure that these industries are not abandoned and left behind. But as to details as to what that actually is in practice and what it is that governments and industry leaders have to do, that wasn't really explained, no. There was a lot of sort of, we'll announce more in the coming weeks, we'll announce more at COP26, but as of yet, no.
Okay. All right, well, that's it for this week. I think we're out of time. Thanks to Rachel Emery there and to Callum Ross and, of course, producer Chris Finn. And, of course, you for listening. We'll be back next week with more. But until then, and even after then, pick up or log on to The Courier, The Press and Journal and all our news brands so that you can be better briefed. Cheerio.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you can be better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph, Evening Express and The Sunday Post work hard day and night, online, in print and beyond, to bring you careful reporting and analysis designed to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, in Westminster and in our communities. So you don't miss an episode, follow The Stooshy today on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you know folk like you who want to understand politics in Scotland a little better, suggest they tune into The Stooshy or follow Stooshy Scott on Twitter and Facebook. You can get a free month of unlimited access to The Courier or The Press and Journal too. Just go to thecourier.co.uk/subscribe or pressandjournal.co.uk/subscribe. Or follow the links in the episode notes to be better briefed. Check the episode notes for details and terms.